Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the History of Byzantium. Episode 148, Sources and Magnates. We've reached the end of our mini end of the century tour. Essentially, we've just clarified what the Byzantine expansion means for the narrative going forward. We've looked at the new lands and the development of the army. We've looked at the enemies rising to challenge the Romans, and we've looked at our sources, asking, how do we know what we know? Today, we return to that topic, and we look ahead to the reign of Basil II. I will be spoiling a lot of the details, but I suspect most of you already know the outline. Basil will spend the first 13 years of his reign dealing with challenges to his rule. John Zimisces' brother-in-law, Bardas Scleros, will be first, then Nicephorus Phocas's nephew, also called Bardas, will follow. Once he's secured himself on the throne, Basil will endure a very long war with the revived Bulgarian state, all the while fending off attacks in the east from the Fatimids. He will reign successfully until 1025, when our century will actually close, and we'll do a proper tour of the Byzantine world. To help us understand Basil's reign, we turn again to Professor Kordelis, whose book, Streams of Gold, Rivers of Blood, covers the whole of this period. Basil will become the longest-serving emperor in Roman history. All of Roman history. And yet, sadly, we suffer from a shortage of sources. Why? Let's ask our expert.
In a nutshell, our sources, our narrative sources, are generally good for the first 13 years, so until the end of the civil wars in the 989, let's say. After that, they become very, very poor, very sparse recording. Our eastern source, so since Basil was primarily active in the Balkans fighting this long war against Bulgaria, our eastern sources in Arabic don't pay that much attention to what was going on in the Balkans. So we don't have that much information from them, which would otherwise have been very, very useful. They're very useful in discussing the civil wars and anything that happened in the east, but not so much for Bulgaria. Also, this is a period, so after the end of the civil wars, Byzantium enters a period of growing prosperity, probably economic and demographic growth. There aren't that many problems, destructive events, riots and that sort of thing to record. There's some earthquakes, of course, in Constantinople. There's one that damages Hagia Sophia, but even that falls within the purview of our narrative sources. They do mention that, but for the other 30 some years, they're very poor. Our main chronicle source is John Skilitzes, and he stops his narrative basically and picks it up again in 1014. And he says that the the Basil and the Bulgarians had been fighting wars every year up to that point, but he's just going to omit it all and just pick up the thread right before the defeat of Bulgaria. It's almost as if he just doesn't want to go slog through the endless raids and counter raids and battles and so on that lasted 30 years, or more actually. So the war with Bulgaria, you can date its beginning to maybe 986, but certainly from the early 990s. And it lasted until 1025. It was one of the longest wars in Roman history. I mean, think about it. It's longer than the Punic Wars. Two empires, very large and powerful states, and Bulgaria is far more powerful at this time than might appear, because we know very little about it, right? We don't have Bulgarian sources. We don't even know exactly the extent of the Bulgarian Empire. But clearly it gave the Byzantines a very hard time. Remember, Byzantium is a state that has basically easily obliterated all of these emirates in the east. Reduced them to client status, you know, reconquered Crete and Cyprus and has been annexing principalities in Armenia and so on. And yet, you know, Bulgaria gives it still incredible amount of difficulty. So it must have been, you know, comparable in some ways. We just don't have that much information about it. So this is one of the longest and most bitterly fought wars in all of Roman history. And yet we know so little about it. Anyway, so it's difficult to reconstruct, but you're right. There's this gap. There's this big gap of information about Basil's reign, especially about Constantinople. We're not even sure that the emperor was there a lot of the time, right? I mean, Basil II is a unique emperor in so many ways, right? The length of his reign, the fact that he never married, right? He seems to have never tried to produce an heir. And also, he left the patriarchate vacant for 4 years this one time. And anyway, so it's possible that Constantinople didn't see the emperor all that much for a long time. That's extraordinary. But we just have no way of picturing it. We can't see what it looks like.
Okay, so let me elaborate. There are four main written sources that I'll talk about. There are more which cover this period, but let's keep things simple. Leo the Deacon, who we talked about a few episodes ago, cuts out just after the civil wars. And then in the East, the Arabic source that Professor Kaldelis referred to is a historian called Yahya of Antioch. He was an Egyptian Christian who grew up in a thoroughly Arabized world, so he has an Arabic name and he speaks Arabic, and under persecution by the Fatimids, he moved to Antioch, where fellow Christian Arabs were migrating, and there he wrote a history. He is our main source for Byzantine-Fatimid conflicts, but understandably doesn't know much about what was going on in the far-off Balkans. Our third source is the Chronicle of John Skylitzes, who was an official in Constantinople. But this was written well over a century from now, which may explain why he has such patchy information on Basil's reign. As you heard in the clip, he just skips over a whole chunk of the Bulgarian War, leaving us to piece together a timeline from other scraps. Finally, there is Michael Psellos, who we will talk a lot more about, including later in this episode. Michael was a polymath and politician who grew up during Basil's reign and served half a dozen emperors in the 11th century. His history is an amazing piece of work, giving character portraits of all these figures. However, he is very selective about details and he has an agenda. So you can see why we have trouble. And Professor Kuldelis was explaining there that it's possible that part of why we don't know more is that Basil wasn't always in the capital to report important news. He will be on campaign relentlessly, as we will see, and thus important information has slipped through the gaps. Connected to this, as you heard, it's also possible that just not a lot happened in the capital that was worth reporting. No major fires, riots, controversies, or political flare-ups. Basil was a successful ruler and the rightful Macedonian heir. He also doesn't seem to have commissioned anyone to write about him, as his grandfather did, which is a shame from our point of view. And what about this not getting married business? This is one of the most curious things about Basil. Very unusual for a Byzantine emperor, very unusual for any kind of ancient, medieval, or modern ruler. I had to ask whether we had any insight into why he remained a bachelor.
No, not in any credible source. There's a Western chronicle, I can't remember the name offhand, that says that Basil took monastic vows. No, he didn't. But it might look that way if you saw it from a distance. The closest we can get to a Byzantine explanation of this is the advice that the defeated rebel Scliros gives to Basil about how to govern, and it's basically something like, don't trust anybody, keep all the nobles busy with, moving them around or threatening them with taxation or something like this. And he also says, and just don't fill the palace with, all these women and intrigue and all of that. So let's go back to the formative experiences that I mentioned earlier. So Basil had seen his mother remarry to Nicephorus Phocas. And that didn't work out well. And then she was exiled by another general who was brought in. And all these ambitious men are trying to replace him. And there's all this intrigue about empresses and imperial marriage connections and who marries whom and how all of these people are all – this aristocracy, especially the military aristocracy, is all intermarried, and they're trying to get their people in the palace and so forth. And he probably – his experience of all of that was that it was just trouble. Who is he going to marry? This would bring her, relatives into the palace, and he would have to – I don't know. Presumably he could have found a way to marry someone acceptable without that kind of trouble, but I think his solution was just not to bring it into the palace. At least this is what's implied in Psellos, who mentions this advice given to him by the rebel Scliros. It remains a mystery, because that's not a very satisfactory explanation.
We will, of course, talk more about this, but perhaps Basil's decision is easier to understand given his experience of life under Phocas and Zimisces. Clearly, no one could be trusted, so why link yourself to a prominent family who will then agitate for influence in the palace? If he'd read about his grandfather's experience of life under Romanus Lecapenus, he would have been doubly warned. This conversation with Bardas Scliros is something we will revisit in detail. You don't need to remember it now. But it's a chat recorded by Michael Psellos, essentially suggesting that the defeated rebel advised the emperor to live the way he did, unmarried, unconnected from others, almost like a monk, to avoid dangerous entanglements. But though this report seems like quite an accurate description of Basil, it is most likely invented by the historian. He wrote with another agenda in mind, as I clarified.
I don't think he set out to distort Basil II. I think that his image of Basil was meant to be a kind of standard of imperial behavior against which later emperors could be found wanting when they were compared to it. So he constructs Basel in a particular way as a kind of very level-headed, down-to-earth, military micromanager. That's kind of the image that emerges. Basel is not interested in any of the pomp and ceremony of the office. He doesn't listen to courtiers or flatterers. He spends all of his time, you know, with the army. He micromanages the army. He's reading the manuals. He's just only interested in those kinds of things. And he's not interested in higher learning or, rhetoric. He's sort of a tough disciplinarian, but he brings home the victories. It's a kind of scientific expertise, right, when it comes to war. It's not glamorous. In fact, Basel is hostile to heroics, right? So his soldiers are not supposed to, rush forward and, attack the enemy on their own and win heroic, Homeric combat. No. Basel punishes those kinds of behaviors, even if they lead to victory, right? So he wants a very disciplined, army under his control. So that's a specific image of military leadership that Psellos constructed. You can see it, how he's constructing it, right? This isn't an immaculate vision of the man as he was. It's a literary construct. Our question, of course, is why does Psellos present Basel that way? That's a separate question. But it is the most striking picture of Basel that we have. Surely to some degree it was accurate. I mean, yes, the man spent his all of his adult life in military camps, probably.
So as you can see, we have to do a certain amount of unpicking to come up with a plausible picture of Basel, despite the length of his reign. However, I'm looking forward to the challenge. I think it's a fascinating tease for us because we haven't seen Basil yet. He was a child when his father died, and Nicephorus Phocas swept into the city and married his mother. He spent the past 2 decades as the legitimate prince, but not allowed anywhere near government by the 2 usurping generals. We might expect him to be a pampered or bookish sort, like his grandfather, Constantine VII, but instead he will become a hardened military man, spending his life constantly prowling the frontiers. A legacy, it might seem, of growing up alongside Phocas and Zimisces, and then nearly being overthrown by their heirs. That brings us to the issue of the landed magnates. We've talked about them a couple of times in detail. Certainly the rich were getting richer, and certainly those in charge of the army were in prime position to expand their portfolios. However, I also sounded warnings from historians who felt that talk of a new magnate class was misleading, and that the legislation issued by various emperors curbing land grabs by the powerful were possibly not intended to actually help the poor. Instead, they were there for political purposes, to collar any nobles not cooperating with the imperial regime by taking away some of their acquisitions. Like iconoclasm or the themes system, there is a lively academic debate about what it all means, and here is Professor Kordelis's take.
One thing that I realized in reading through the sources and trying to understand the events was that one of the main narratives about this period that I had been taught in grad school and that you read in many of the standard sources, the histories, just wasn't there. And this was the idea that this period was marked by a tension and hostilities between, on the one hand, the Macedonian dynasty, the court system, and on the other hand, the so-called big landowners of Asia Minor. And the big landowners were assumed to be the same as the military officer class. And so there's some kind of socioeconomic class warfare going on between the centralized state and and the quasi or proto-feudal military land-owning aristocracy. So I came to the conclusion, just looking in the sources, that we don't have any evidence for such a quasi-feudal land-owning aristocracy. And if one existed, it was probably the church. It had nothing to do with the generals. To make a long story short, I mean, I discuss these issues in the book in some detail, but whenever the military class took the throne, or whenever officers from this military background took the throne with their names like Phocas or Komnenos or whatever, they pursued the same kinds of policies with respect to land that the Macedonian emperors had. They kept the same legislation in power. Sometimes they enforced it. Sometimes they even strengthened it. They did nothing to suggest that they're implementing some kind of class agenda, which suggested to me that the conflicts were not, in fact, about state policy regarding land and rents and taxes, but in fact were about the army, control of the army, and also the salaries. And it turns out, if you look at recent studies of the Byzantine aristocracy and the court system, that the court salaries, say, paid to top generals, were probably a larger source of revenue for them than their own personal land would have been. We actually don't have any proof that these generals were great landowners. I mean, they probably were, because that's where you invest wealth, right, in the Middle Ages. But their land was not the source of their power. Consistently, again and again, the source of their power was holding office and having acquired prestige in the holding of that office, plus the salaries that came with that office. So I ended up rejecting this socioeconomic model of landowning class warfare, which is a model that had been an attempt to, you know, kind of force Byzantium into a sort of loosely Marxist view of history and finally make it, you know, get with the program and get feudal. I don't think that happened during this period. And instead, I suggest a different socioeconomic model that's based on state revenues and staff and salaries when it comes to the civil wars. Now, when it comes to the church sort of acquiring more and more land in the province was clearly happening. And I think that the emperors were more concerned about the church as a landowner than their own officers. But that's a separate dynamic. That, as far as I can tell, never played into the civil wars, never played into, you know, the military history of Byzantium, or really even the political history. So those kinds of narratives have to be kept separate. That's the major framework argument.
So to bring it all the way back to where we are in 976, poised for these civil wars, it's not that Phocas and Scleros are landed magnates with an agenda against the sitting emperor. It's that their families have been in charge of the whole military apparatus for the last 50 years, and the state is now threatening to appoint other men and, you know, reduce their influence over it.
Exactly. In fact, had reduced their influence. So in the cases of both rebels, Scleros and Phocas, their rebellions follow acts which they probably saw as quasi-demotions. And they saw that the court was trying to diminish their influence with the armies, possibly build up counter groups of you know, potential generals or actual generals to use them, you know, as a counterweight. And the Phocades had gotten quite used to running the state for a long time. Scleros had been the top guy under Tzimiskis. And so there was just discontent about the loss of standing and prestige and, you know, power. Now, don't forget also that Byzantium at this very moment is owns the most powerful armies around. You know, these aren't the old thematic troops that are being called up every year for an annual, you know, counter raid or something. I mean, obviously, yes, there are a number of those kinds of soldiers still in the armed forces, but they also have much more significant body of professional full-time soldiers who have an experience of successful conquest now. And so these are more powerful armies. And control over these more powerful weapons is something that drives a lot of the conflict. I think they would have been happy if Basel had just remained a mere figurehead, you know, possibly even accepting another general, you know, handler as co-emperor. I think that's what these guys wanted. But you'll notice that they never say, oh, we're, you know, we want to overthrow the emperor because we want to reduce restrictions on acquiring more land. Not only do they never say that, they never do that even when they do win. So that just doesn't seem to be a part of the dynamic. The generals, when they took the throne, also wanted to keep powerful armies funded in exactly the same way. So it really is a struggle over control of state resources, the army and the tax system. They didn't want to change them, just wanted to control them.
So he comes down very much on the side of those arguing that there is no class conflict going on here, and that the reason that the Phocads and the Korkuai rebel against the crown is not because they were wealthy magnates, but because they had been in control of the army for decades, and they move against the emperor in order to maintain their domination over the state machinery. I hope that's helped answer listener ST's question, which was what makes these military rebellions different from the various army revolts of earlier centuries. In many ways, there is no difference, only that the army was more powerful now than it was then. The public of the capital turned on Nicephorus because of his specific policies, not because he was an Eastern magnate. They soon embraced Zimisces, who was from the exact same background. However, I think there is more to explore here. The emperors had invested so much power in the Phocads and the Korkuai for a reason, in part because both families were dominant in their local communities. This helped ensure that they would be able to fill the ranks of the army. You see, although the Byzantines had tax registers and the theme system, it was still a medieval state. If men didn't turn up to the mustering grounds, there's not a lot a general could do about it. He needed all his men there to form the army. He couldn't spare anyone to march around the countryside chasing delinquent soldiers. That's why a successful general was so valuable. Men would willingly follow a call-up from a Nicephorus Phocas, because they respected him and they expected a return on their investment. In other words, he's a winner and I will get my hands on loot. When a no-name general from the capital rode by asking for men to honour their obligations, he was more likely to find reports of mysterious illnesses. Similarly, the magnate families were chosen because they had close ties with the Armenian and Iberian worlds. They may have shared ancestry with those in the mountains and certainly cultivated good relations with them for trade and grazing purposes. As you know, the cooperation of the Armenians was vital to Byzantine success. So again, appointing someone with no local connections to command the armies was not a good idea. So even though the magnates may not have had a class agenda, and even though control of the army was still at the heart of their rebellions, there is still a cultural difference with some of the earlier army revolts. When we get to 1025, I plan to explore the culture of the borderlands to understand the different attitudes that prevail there compared to those of the streets of Constantinople. I asked for questions for this mini tour, and a load of really good ones came in. However, most of them were too general for me to deal with now. They've all gone into the file and will be answered in 1025, when I will ask for more questions. Listener AW brings us to a close, though, by asking one last time about Nicephorus Phocas. Why wasn't such a successful general, who had done so much for the empire, mourned by more people in Byzantium? It's a good question, and obviously we don't know enough to know what the general perception really was. Perhaps there was a lot more ill feeling than we hear about, or maybe Nicephorus was despised by the population of the capital to an extent that we can't comprehend. Nicephorus was a war hero, and the capture of Crete was a huge triumph. I sometimes wonder what the people who lived on the Bosphorus really knew about Cilicia or Melitene. I'm not sure if they fully comprehended what he'd achieved. After all, raids that reached western Anatolia were pretty rare by this point. As I mentioned at the time, I assume that John defeating the Rus was seen by many as far more impressive. And maybe John being the one who replaced him is key to the muted reaction. The great general was replaced by another great general. Cynically, people may have felt that all they had lost was Nicephorus's unpopular policies. By one account, Zimisces went about handing out cash to every church and institution in the capital, and that's a shameless bid for popularity, but it seems to have worked. We should remember, too, that Nicephorus's military reputation did live on in poems and in histories, and that his family would go on rebelling against Constantinople for decades and would always find support for their cause. So his good name did live on, even if the people of the capital seem to have moved on rather quickly. So, next week, we are back into the narrative. John is dead, and Basil steps into the light. But you will also get another episode in the middle of the week. I will be releasing the full interview with Anthony Kaldelis. There is plenty of conversation that I haven't used on the show so far, including discussion about what comes after Basil II. I'll provide some time indicators if you want to skip to the bits you haven't heard. But let me close by saying I recommend the book very highly. And if you are studying this period of Byzantine history, it is a must read.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.